Good morning and welcome. You are tuned into 2SER 107.3, and as it is 10 a.m. on a Saturday morning, it means final draft time. What a month so far for reading, for writing, for just kind of loving literature. I hope you had a good time at Sydney Writers Festival last weekend. If you didn't get a chance to get down there, I mean, it was amazing fun, and I would recommend looking up some of the great stuff that was happening. One way you can do that is on the Final Draft Great Conversations podcast, and that's available wherever you get podcasts. And on there, you're going to find so many great Australian writers who were at the festival discussing their work, discussing ideas. But the festival fun doesn't end. I had so many wonderful conversations during the festival. I'm going to keep sharing them. Which brings me to today, Saturday, the 11th of May, I have got two absolutely stunning collections of poetry. But before I introduce them, these poets are also going to be exploring the ways that we read, the ways that we engage, the ways that we, as readers, become a part of and interact with the texts that we read. This was an amazing journey meeting both of these poets, and I'm just so happy to be sharing. And without further ado, I'm gonna tell you. So the first conversation is with Alison Whittaker. She is a Gomeroi poet and an academic at UTS. And her collection from late last year is Black Work. It's out through Mugabala Books. And Alison came into the studio, and we discussed her work, the themes of work, and also about ideas of black work in her writing, in her literature, in her life. The other poet that will be joining me on today's show is Omar Saker. His latest collection is The Lost Arabs, and it is a stunning examination of identity and community, of violence and peace, and the ways that we construct ourselves and understand ourselves. I loved meeting Omar as well. Both of these poets are extraordinary for their writing, but also extraordinary for the ways that they have us ask questions. So that is Alison Whittaker's Black Work and Omar Saker's The Lost Arabs on today's Final Draft, coming up after this short break.
On Saturday, May 25, the Back to Funk barbecue returns for another top session at the Vic. It's an afternoon of first-class funk, soul, reggae, hip-hop, disco, Latin and boogie, featuring sets from Meme, Gian Arpino, Jay Reddy, DJ Yone and Shireen Da Silva. Family and dog-friendly, good food, good music, good people. The Back to Funk Autumn Barbecue Sessions on Saturday, May 25. 2SER is a media partner of the Back to Funk Barbecues.
Good morning, you are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. You're listening to Final Draft, and my name is Andrew Popel. I'm joined in the studio right now by Alison Whittaker. Alison is a Gomeroi poet and legal researcher from the floodplains of Gunnedah in New South Wales. Her first book of poetry was Lemons in the Chicken Wire. Her second, out last year, is Black Work, and that's what we're going to be talking about today. Alison, thank you for coming into 2SER.
Oh, yeah, Andrew, it's good to be here.
Now, Black Work collects poetries, an essay, covering personal and social biography, satire, critique. It explores your life as a First Nations woman, as a poet, as a lawyer. It's not mine, though, to sort of categorise and say too much about. It's yours, your story, your collection. I was wondering if you could introduce it for me in your own words.
Oh, yeah. Black Work is a multi-form collection of stuff that I tried to use to explain and provoke a broader conversation about Indigenous labour, Indigenous bodies and Indigenous country, and then the work that they've been put to as kind of a supporting beam for the colony. And looking back into how that's happened, looking into the present, into how people are trying to agitate against that, and looking forward into the future about what the capacity for Indigenous labour means as an act of liberation.
Mm. So when I initially approached Black Work, I read it as I read any book of poetry. I jump around. I don't know if you're a straight through or a jump around person, but I tend to jump around. And then, I mean, it was only a week ago, mm-hmm. as we speak right now, that you gave the Wheeler Centre's The F Word address. And after listening to what you had to say, I realised that I needed to do some work before we spoke. Mm-hmm. And in the address and in your conversation with Claire G. Coleman, you spoke about audience. You mm-hmm. spoke about readership. And the ways First Nation writers and writing is received by a wide audience, or by any audience that You guess I don't. You compared other ways of audience being controlled, and I particularly like that example of the military using poetry.
Mm.
You also spoke about anti-colonial writing and decolonizing reading, and the body of works that we consume, about the power of poetry and storytelling, that it's powerful when the audience takes up the challenge of the narrative, and that reading isn't simply an end in itself.
Mm.
So you got me thinking about what this might even look like as I sat down to reread many of the poems that I'd already touched on in Black Work. And I wanted to start with this because I knew that it would be easy for us to have this conversation on the terms of my consumption of your work and my understanding of your work, but I didn't want to do that. So you got me thinking, that's going to mean acknowledging that when I learn about poetry, the way that I learn about poetry at school, at uni, it was almost exclusively from old white guys teaching dead white guys who mostly were writing at a time when much of the crimes of colonialism were being committed.
Mm.
It would mean for me to acknowledge that my ways of speaking and thinking are not the only ways to formulate and express language, and that people who express themselves differently, they're not wrong just because their usage sounds different to mine.
Mm.
And it would also mean acknowledging that when I felt challenged, maybe attacked, or that topics or ideas contradict the world that I grew up in, acknowledging that I have the privilege to step back from that, and I can step away from challenging thoughts and just continue my life, that I can choose to engage with these ideas or not, because they're not part of my everyday and my battle for recognition and legitimacy, and trying to approach it with those eyes and trying to understand it. Now, I don't know if I'm doing this right, but I wanted to share some of those thoughts because I know that many, if not most, of our listeners are going to be people like me. They're white, they're middle class, they're privileged, even if we're blind to it most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that if we start to do this, it's going to benefit us in reading our work, in reading all work.
Mm.
That was a lot, sorry, and I'm going to shut up so that you can actually have a turn.
That's fine. I mean, yeah, there's something good about confronting the reading process. F word address references you were talking about, they are the work of our associate professor Sandra Phillips, who's a scholar here at UTS, and of Evelyn Araluen, who's a PhD candidate at UCID, and both of them are kind of working with really complex theoretical frameworks about how people engage and disengage with work. One of the reasons I wrote and said what I said in the F word address was because of a very personal disappointment with how people engaged with the work and the kind of audience that I attracted. The tension that I felt most strongly was that I was trying to present, in Lemons and the Chicken Wire, which was my first book, trying to paint an explanatory picture. And the engagement that I got with that was with people kind of thinking of it as very exotic or interesting. And that's not really what I wanted, like, to be consumed in that way as a full person, rather than people engaging with the work itself and what it meant for them. And then when I wrote Black Work, it was in response to that. So I wanted to be a little more provocative. I wanted to be able to acknowledge that people like yourself are my dominant audience, and also at the same time create a book that accepts that dominant audience as a kind of collateral certainty of publishing, but really wanting to affect and represent and be faithful to a Black readership. And in both books, the largest audience that I attracted found ways to kind of sidestep, I think, what I was trying to do, and found ways to assimilate the accusations, I think, that came in the book into evidence of their goodness. And Evelyn Araluen talks about this when she writes about people thinking that it's enough to just read Aboriginal poetry as activism and that's kind of the end of it, whereas actually we're trying to use it as I can't speak for everyone. Some Aboriginal poets are using poetry to urge political mobilization or to urge legal mobilization or to urge healing or to do something very purposeful. But it's worth interrogating whether our readership is on the same page as us, and the limitations of when you don't control your audience, how you can get them to do your bidding. It's a really, really hard task that I'm not well equipped for, but that's that's fine. I'm young. There are people much older than me doing this, and they need to be acknowledged as well.
So let's talk about work then. Mm-hmm. It is a word that recurs throughout the collection, but I also want to talk about another term that is gaining currency, that we're gaining understanding of, and that's emotional labour, where emotional mm-hmm. labour lies. And it seems to me very much a traditional power dynamic is that the dominant culture requires that emotional labour from everyone else to use words like assimilate, to fit in, to, if they have a complaint to bring to the table, to do all the work to make the dominant culture understand. Mm. And the first poem I wanted us to talk about is actually the poem that opens the collection, Black Work. Mm-hmm. And it ends with the line, I love the way your work scans, the aesthetic of the way your work scans.
Thank you.
Because this line can be read in two ways, and it starts with compulsory to do, but it can also be read as sorry to do.
Mm.
Sorry to do, indentured black work, something like 9 to 5 forgiving you. And this theme of work and this juxtaposition of white work and black work, and I read white work as this ongoing damage being done. Just by doing nothing, this white work is continually damaging. Whereas black work is, this, as you say, this 9 to 5 forgiving you, this work that's required to somehow do the emotional labour, but then also forgive the people who want to make reading performative and wring their hands about white guilt.
Mm.
Tell me about what you wanted to do with this idea of work in the book.
Yeah, I mean, that the poem that you're talking about was one of the first ones I wrote in the collection, and it was before I realised I was going to write a collection about work. I wrote it in response to, it was part of a triptych for a journal called The Suburban Review. When I put it together, I was kind of infuriated about how I felt in my workplace as a legal scholar, how I felt as a law student, kind of processing these things all the time. And it's something I really see emulated in that episode of Get Kraken with Miranda Tapsell and Nakia Louie.
Required viewing.
Required viewing. Just, yeah, a riot in every sense of the word. I really loved it. But there's this monologue where Miranda Tapsell, in the character that's crafted for her within the story of that episode, talks about all these things that you kind of have to do in order to even just tread water at a workplace. And I think of that kind of as white work. So white work isn't really done by white people. White people don't think of whiteness. Whereas we work in ways that are very, very tightly cognizant of whiteness and conscious of how we have to navigate it. And in that episode, Miranda Tapsell says, you know, you got to make your eyes big, you got to always be smiling, you got to buy cupcakes for the crew so they like you. And I was kind of feeling a similar moment. I think of myself as a pretty sunny person. trying to work through an entitlement to anger, an entitlement to withholding forgiveness, which can be quite powerful. So this concept of work kind of started within this like kind of gut frustration that ultimately had a real effect on my body, caused like health complications and anxiety and mental health stuff. But in taking the concept bigger than my body, also in the level of the collection, I think reflected something much more bigger and structural. It was much less about kind of the interpersonal stuff you do in the day-to-day and more about seeing something that's constantly replicating the need for you to do so. And that, in a way, was gratifying to see as the collection came together, that one, it wasn't just happening to me, which is both a good and bad thing to realise, and two, that like as one individual you bear a burden to work against it, but there's no way you can do it by yourself.
The voice you're listening to is Alison Whittaker. She is a Gomeroi poet and legal researcher. She's the author, the poet behind Black Work, the collection we've been discussing poems from. I'm incredibly grateful for you coming in and just the chance to discuss just a small part of this collection. I'm going to encourage everyone to go out and get a copy. Thank you so much, Alison.
Oh, thank you.
You are on 2SER 107.3 and you're listening to Final Draft, Books, Writing and Literary Culture, every week on your radio. Thank you again to Alison Whittaker. That conversation was recorded during Sydney Writers' Festival last weekend. If you want to hear the full conversation with Alison Whittaker and discover more about her amazing collection, Blackwork, you can get the full conversation right now on the Final Draft Great Conversations podcast. Well, don't go anywhere. It's actually going to be up at the end of the show. Now, Omar Saker is coming up next. We're going to discuss his collection, The Lost Arabs. To get us there, though, we've got a track just to kind of help you reset. This is from Clinic, and it's called Forbidden Fish.
Season 2 of All Things Equal.
And she said he's got special needs. He needs to be with his own kind.
His own kind?
Where you'll hear real student stories.
Because I almost overdosed in my vice principal's office, so I was suspended for 20 days.
To discover that not all schools and not all students are equal.
New episodes of All Things Equal are available now. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. You're listening to Final Draft, and my name is Andrew Popel. And I'm joined in the studio by Omar Saker. Omar is an Arab-Australian poet from Western Sydney. His first collection of poetry, These Wild Houses, was shortlisted for the Judith Wright Award and the Kenneth Slessor Prize for Poetry. He's been published widely in journals and anthologies, and he's here today with a new collection, The Lost Arabs. Omar, welcome to 2SER.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming in, because I found this a beautiful collection, but I was also struck by the fact that I'm reading from my own particular position as a white, cisgendered, straight male. Living in Sydney, I live in Australia, you know, I'm part of a settler society on essentially stolen land. Now, my perspective in some ways may mirror yours, but is also in other ways miles from your experience. And I wondered, as you write, what does readership mean to you, if it means anything?
Yeah, that's a great question. Obviously, everyone reads from their own particular subjectivities. And I am similar in the sense that, you know, I am an Arab Muslim bisexual, also living on stolen land. And it's important that we acknowledge the kind of colonial monstrosity that we're living in and the damage it's doing to various bodies, in particular indigenous bodies, but also refugees and also new migrants, and in particular in my case, you know, on Arabs and Muslims. So the idea of readership is very important, right? I think there's a focus on writers. I think there's a focus on writing, you know, who's allowed to write what, for example. But not enough focus on reading, because I think it's one of the most extraordinarily intimate things you can do is to read. Because what you're doing when you're reading is you're allowing another voice to enter your mind. That most personal space. You're allowing another voice to enter your mind. You're allowing another history to enter your mind. And there's no defense against that once you are allowing someone in. But I think that's why there's so much pushback so often from white writers who are like, well, we're allowed to write whatever we want. You know what I mean? We're allowed to, where we can, you know, it's an act of empathy. No, it's an act of ego. An act of empathy would be to actually read the work of indigenous writers, of Arab writers, of Muslim writers, to allow our voices uncensored to enter your mind, our histories, our pain, our joys, our loves, you know, our fantasies and our nightmares, because we already have lived and experienced, you know, the manifold white versions of that. So it's important to me for sure that I'm read and that I'm read well. And in particular, you know, I write foremost for queer Arabs, queer people of color, Muslims. I hope always to be able to pay back the debt that I owe to the writers who helped save my life, who helped me get through the hardships that I've faced. I feel a debt. And so I write in the hopes that the people who need it most will find my voice the way that I found other voices.
So the flip side of that then is how voices are asked for or even demanded. And the burden perhaps that is put on people to perform, to explain, to be a certain way. And I was struck by the opening of your poem, Meaning. And if I can... I'm tired of summoning my heritage out of a battered magician's hat. And through Meaning, you explore places of welcoming and exile, and you plead, do not draw fixed lines around my origin. So I wondered then about how the performance of your poetry, how does that intersect with your identity and the reader's calling forth a version of you?
Yeah. So I have a complicated background. My father was Turkish. He was born in Turkey. My mother is Lebanese. She was born in Lebanon, and I was born here. But I was raised with my Lebanese family only. So, you know, I'm aware that I have multiple heritages. I'm also bisexual. So I'm aware always that for some people I'm too Arab, you know, or I'm too Turkish, or amongst those communities I'm too Australian, or, you know, too Muslim to the wider Australian community, or not Muslim enough, or not Arab enough, or not Turkish enough, or not male enough, or too male, or do you know what I mean? Like, I have a number of communities to which I belong, and but that's not the entirety of me, and I'm aware always of how those identities are received. And there are strategies that you can employ, I think, around that. But for me, it's sort of like I wanted in this book to explore multiple versions of myself. Not, there's no one true, authentic self. There are multiple versions of me that have played out in different communities and in different poems. So I just wanted to kind of give voice to them.
It sounds like naming, or perhaps even the privilege of not having to be named, plays a big role. And I was struck then by you talking about different identities and how in different spaces you can be more than or not enough of one. And in the poem Self-Portrait of What Graces the Night, the line, so the moon does not identify as moon. So it has this privilege of not having to name because nobody has tried to crush it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's that's really perceptive. I do think that we have been named in an attempt to limit us. And the naming, the original kind of act of naming in Western societies was derogatory. It was negative. We were supposed to be ashamed of it, of our histories and of where we come from, and we're seen as backward and uncultured and all of these things. So there is definitely a power in reclaiming that name and saying, I'm going to use it, in fact, as a way to survive. Mm. And I think that's something that's been going on for, sadly, you know, generations of migrant writers, of like the undesired or unacceptable, the writers from the margins, who have been doing this kind of work. And I think, you know, with all this stuff about identity politics today, I think it's a reaction to the fact that we're taking pride in it now, because we were never meant to. Mm. We were never meant to find common ground. We were never meant to be like in solidarity with each other. We were never meant to be like, yeah, I'm Arab and I'm proud. You know, there's a long history of Arab being said as a dirty word. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I've lived through. I've heard people say it like it's the most disgusting thing they've ever encountered. And there's, you know, if you know the work of Jack G. Shaheen, who, you know, spent his life documenting Hollywood movies and TV shows that depicted Arabs, you know, thousands of movies over 100 years showing Arabs in as caricatures, mm-hmm. as untrustworthy, as savages. It's really extraordinary how relentless that imagining is of us. Mm-hmm. And we have to be equally relentless in saying, no, you do not get to define us. You know, we have to do the complicated and messy defining of ourselves. And there's no real right way to do it. You know, I'm not interested in saying, I am this one thing, or this one thing that I am is perfect, is valuable, is moral, or any of that. You know what I mean? It's messy, it's complicated, it's human.
Omar Seker is the author of The Lost Arabs. It is a collection of poems that is out now. I cannot encourage you, dear listener, more to check it out. Omar, thank you so much for coming into the studio.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Head On Photo Festival is here. Get down to Paddington Town Hall and check out the festival hub. Enjoy some of the world's best photography as exhibitors showcase their stories and ideas from across the globe. The festival hub is open 7 days a week, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. from May 4th to 19th, featuring over 18 exhibitions in the precinct. And best of all, they're free. For more information about this and other festival events around Sydney, go to headon.com.au. 2SER is a proud media partner of Head On Photo Festival 2019.
Yes, you are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. This is Final Draft for but a few moments longer. I want to say thank you again today to Alison Whittaker. She's a Gomeroi poet. Her latest collection is Blackwork. Also to Omar Seker, and his latest collection is The Lost Arabs, for their generosity, their time, their beautiful collections. Now, I recorded these conversations during Sydney Writers Festival, so what you heard today is just the tip of the iceberg. You want to get to the Final Draft Great Conversations podcast, where my full conversation with Alison and my full conversation with Omar are available as the latest episodes. I really encourage you to catch up on all the great Sydney Writers Festival content. If you're enjoying the show, please give us a rating, share it with friends, and also give a shout out to your favorite artists. Go and get their books and let them know what you think of them. I will be back next week with more books, writing and literary culture on election weekend. Let's see. I've got some really interesting stuff to reflect on our history as a democracy. Don't go anywhere, though. The Vulture's Nest is coming up. It's still a great day of radio here at 2SER. My name is Andrew Popel, and until next week, happy reading.